the course of evolution in the computer seem paradoxical? Does it mean that something mysterious, even mystical, was going on inside the computer? Of course not. Nor is there anything mystical going on in the evolution of real animals and plants. We can use the computer model to resolve the paradox and learn something about real evolution in the process. To anticipate, the basis of the resolution of the paradox will turn out to be as follows. There is a definite set of biomorphs, each permanently sitting in its own unique place in a mathematical space. It is permanently sitting there in the sense that, if only you knew its genetic formula, you could instantly find it. Moreover, its neighbours in this special kind of space are the biomorphs that differ from it by only one gene. Now that we know the genetic formula of the insects, we can reproduce them at will and can tell the computer to evolve towards them from any arbitrary starting point. When you first evolve a new creature by artificial selection in the computer model, it feels like a creative process. So it is, indeed. But what you are really doing is finding the creature, for it is, in a mathematical sense, already sitting in its own place in the genetic space of biomorph land. The reason it is a truly creative process is that finding any particular creature is extremely difficult, simply and purely because biomorph land is very, very large, and the total number of creatures sitting there is all but infinite. It isn't feasible just to search aimlessly and at random. You have to adopt some more efficient, creative searching procedure. Some people fondly believe that chess-playing computers work by internally trying out all possible combinations of chess moves. They find this belief comforting when a computer beats them, but their belief is utterly false. There are far too many possible chess moves. The search space is billions of times too large to allow blind stumbling to succeed. The art of writing a good chess program is thinking of efficient shortcuts through the search space. Cumulative selection, whether artificial selection as in the computer model, or natural selection out there in the real world, is an efficient searching procedure, and its consequences look very like creative intelligence. That, after all, is what William Paley's argument from design was all about. Technically, all that we are doing when we play the computer biomorph game is finding animals that, in a mathematical sense, are waiting to be found. What it feels like is a process of artistic creation. Searching a small space with only a few entities in it doesn't ordinarily feel like a creative process. A child's game of hunt the thimble doesn't feel creative. Turning things over at random and hoping to stumble on the sought object usually works when the space to be searched is small. As the search space gets larger, more and more sophisticated searching procedures become necessary. Effective searching procedures become, when the search space is sufficiently large, indistinguishable from true creativity. The computer biomorph models make these points well, and they constitute an instructive bridge between human creative processes, such as planning a winning strategy at chess, and the evolutionary creativity of natural selection, the blind watchmaker. To see this, we must develop the idea of biomorph land as a mathematical space, an endless but orderly vista of morphological variety, but one in which every creature is sitting in its correct place, waiting to be discovered. In biomorph land, each creature occupies its own unique position, determined by its genetic formula, surrounded by its own particular neighbours. All the creatures in biomorph land have a definite spatial relationship one to another. What does that mean? What meaning can we attach to spatial position?
The space we're talking about is genetic space. Each animal has its own position in genetic space. Near neighbours in genetic space are animals that differ from one another by only a single mutation. In the earlier example, the basic tree in the centre is surrounded by 18 of its immediate neighbours in genetic space. The 18 neighbours of an animal are the 18 different kinds of children that it can give rise to, and the 18 different kinds of parent from which it could have come, given the rules of our computer model. At one remove, each animal has 324 neighbours, 18 times 18, ignoring back mutations for simplicity, the set of its possible grandchildren, grandparents, aunts or nieces. At one remove again, each animal has 5,832 neighbours, 18 times 18 times 18, the set of possible great-grandchildren, great-grandparents, first cousins, etc. What is the point of thinking in terms of genetic space? Where does it get us? The answer is that it provides us with a way to understand evolution as a gradual, cumulative process. In any one generation, according to the rules of the computer model, it is possible to move only a single step through genetic space. In 29 generations, it isn't possible to move farther than 29 steps in genetic space away from the starting ancestor. Every evolutionary history consists of a particular pathway or trajectory through genetic space. For instance, the evolutionary history described earlier, connecting a dot to an insect and passing through 28 intermediate steps, is a particular winding trajectory through genetic space. It is this that I mean when I talk metaphorically about wandering through biomorph land. I wanted to represent this genetic space in the form of a picture. The trouble is, pictures are two-dimensional. The genetic space in which the biomorphs sit is not two-dimensional space. It isn't even three-dimensional space. It's nine-dimensional space. The important thing to remember about mathematics is not to be frightened. It isn't as difficult as the mathematical priesthood sometimes pretends. Whenever I feel intimidated, I always remember Sylvanus Thompson's dictum in Calculus Made Easy, "What one fool can do, another can." If only we could draw in nine dimensions, we could make each dimension correspond to one of the nine genes. The position of a particular biomorph, say the scorpion or the bat or the insect, is fixed in genetic space by the numerical value of its nine genes. Evolutionary change consists of a step-by-step walk through nine-dimensional space. The amount of genetic difference between one animal and another, and hence the time taken to evolve, and the difficulty of evolving from one to the other, is measured as the distance in nine-dimensional space from one to the other. If the insect and the scorpion, for example, are 30 genetic steps distant from one another, it takes only 30 generations to evolve from one to the other, if you never take a wrong turning, if, that is, you know exactly what genetic formula you're heading towards and how to steer towards it. In real-life evolution, there is nothing that corresponds to steering towards some distant genetic target. Let's now use the biomorphs to return to the point made by the monkeys typing Hamlet, the importance of gradual, step-by-step change in evolution, as opposed to pure chance. Instead of measuring distance as number of genes that have to change in evolution, we're going to measure distance as odds of happening to jump the distance by sheer luck in a single hop. To think about this, we now have to relax one of the restrictions that I built into the computer game. We shall end by seeing why I built that restriction in the first place. The restriction was that children were only allowed to be one mutation distant from their parents. In other words, only one gene was allowed to mutate at a time, and that gene was allowed to change its value only by plus one or minus one. By relaxing the restriction, we are now allowing any number of genes to mutate simultaneously, and they can add any number, positive or negative, to their current value. Actually, that is too great a relaxation, since it allows genetic values to range from minus infinity to plus infinity. The point is adequately made if we restrict gene values to single figures, that is, if we allow them to range from minus 9 to plus 9. So, within these wide limits, we are theoretically allowing mutation at a stroke in a single generation to change any combination of the nine genes. Moreover, the value of each gene can change any amount, so long as it doesn't stray into double figures. What does this mean? It means that, theoretically, evolution can jump in a single generation from any point in biomorph land to any other. Not just any point on one plane, but any point in the entire nine-dimensional hypervolume. If, for instance, you should want to jump in one fell swoop from the insect to the fox, here is the recipe. Add the following numbers to the values of genes 1 to 9, respectively. Minus 2, 2, 2, minus 2, 2, 0, minus 4, minus 1, 1. But since we are talking about random jumps, all points in Biomorph Land are equally likely as destinations for one of these jumps. So the odds against jumping to any particular destination, say the fox, by sheer luck, are easy to calculate. They are simply the total number of biomorphs in the space. As you can see, we are embarking on another of those calculations. There are 9 genes, and each of them can take any of 19 values. So the total number of biomorphs that we could jump to in a single step is 19 times itself 9 times over, 19 to the power 9. This works out as about 500 billion biomorphs. Paltry compared with Asimov's hemoglobin number, but still what I would call a large number. If you started from the insect and jumped like a demented flea 500 billion times, you could expect to arrive at the fox once. What is all this telling us about real evolution? Once again, it is ramming home the importance of gradual, step-by-step change. There have been evolutionists who have denied that gradualism of this kind is necessary in evolution. Our biomorph calculation shows us exactly one reason why gradual, step-by-step change is important. When I say that you can expect evolution to jump from the insect to one of its immediate neighbours, but not to jump from the insect directed to the fox or the scorpion, what I exactly mean is the following. If genuinely random jumps really occurred, then a jump from insect to scorpion would be perfectly possible. Indeed, it would be just as probable as a jump from insect to one of its immediate neighbours. But it would also be just as probable as a jump to any other biomorph in the land, and there's the rub. For the number of biomorphs in the land is 500 billion, and if no one of them is any more probable as a destination than any other, the odds of jumping to any particular one are small enough to ignore.
Notice that it doesn't help us to assume that there is a powerful non-random selection pressure. It wouldn't matter if you'd been promised a king's ransom if you achieved a lucky jump to the scorpion. The odds against your doing so are still 500 billion to 1. But if, instead of jumping, you walked one step at a time and were given one small coin as a reward every time you happened to take a step in the right direction, you would reach the scorpion in a very short time. Not necessarily in the fastest possible time of 30 generations, but very fast nevertheless. Jumping could theoretically get you the prize faster, in a single hop. But because of the astronomical odds against success, a series of small steps, each one building on the accumulated success of previous steps, is the only feasible way.
The tone of the previous paragraphs is open to a misunderstanding which I must dispel. It sounds once again as though evolution deals in distant targets homing in on things like scorpions. As we've seen, it never does. But if we think of our target as anything that would improve survival chances, the argument still works. If an animal is a parent, it must be good enough to survive at least to adulthood. It is possible that a mutant child of that parent might be even better at surviving. But if a child mutates in a big way, so that it has moved a long distance away from its parent in genetic space, what are the odds of its being better than its parent?
The answer is that the odds against are very large indeed. And the reason is the one we've just seen with our biomorph model. If the mutational jump we are considering is a very large one, the number of possible destinations of that jump is astronomically large. And because, as we saw in Chapter 1, the number of different ways of being dead is so much greater than the number of different ways of being alive, the chances are very high that a big random jump in genetic space will end in death. Even a small random jump in genetic space is pretty likely to end in death. But the smaller the jump, the less likely death is, and the more likely it is that the jump will result in improvement. We shall return to this theme in a later chapter.
That is as far as I want to go in drawing morals from Biomorph Land. I hope that you didn't find it too abstract. There is another mathematical space filled not with 9-gene biomorphs, but with flesh and blood animals made of billions of cells, each containing tens of thousands of genes. This is not biomorph space, but real genetic space. The actual animals that have ever lived on Earth are a tiny subset of the theoretical animals that could exist.
These real animals are the products of a very small number of evolutionary trajectories through genetic space. The vast majority of theoretical trajectories through animal space give rise to impossible monsters. Real animals are dotted around here and there among the hypothetical monsters, each perched in its own unique place in genetic hyperspace. Each real animal is surrounded by a little cluster of neighbors, most of whom have never existed, but a few of whom are its ancestors, its descendants, and its cousins. Sitting somewhere in this huge mathematical space are humans and hyenas, amoebas and aardvarks, flatworms and squids, dodos and dinosaurs. In theory, if we were skilled enough at genetic engineering, we could move from any point in animal space to any other point. From any starting point, we could move through the maze in such a way as to recreate the dodo, the tyrannosaur, and trilobites. If only we knew which genes to tinker with, which bits of chromosome to duplicate, invert, or delete.
I doubt if we shall ever know enough to do it, but these dear dead creatures are lurking there forever in their private corners of that huge genetic hypervolume, waiting to be found if we but had the knowledge to navigate the right course through the maze. We might even be able to evolve an exact reconstruction of a dodo by selectively breeding pigeons, though we'd have to live a million years in order to complete the experiment. But when we are prevented from making a journey in reality, the imagination is not a bad substitute. For those like me who are not mathematicians, the computer can be a powerful friend to the imagination. Like mathematics, it doesn't only stretch the imagination, it also disciplines and controls it. Chapter 4. Making Tracks Through Animal Space. As we saw in Chapter 2, many people find it hard to believe that something like the eye, Paley's favorite example, so complex and well-designed, with so many interlocking working parts, could have arisen from small beginnings by a gradual series of step-by-step changes. Let's return to the problem in the light of such new intuitions as the biomorphs may have given us. Answer the following two questions.
1. Could the human eye have arisen directly from no eye at all in a single step? 2. Could the human eye have arisen directly from something slightly different from itself, something that we may call X?
The answer to question 1 is clearly a decisive no. The odds against a yes answer for questions like question 1 are many billions of times greater than the number of atoms in the universe. It would need a gigantic and vanishingly improbable leap across genetic hyperspace. The answer to question 2 is equally clearly yes, provided only that the difference between the modern eye and its immediate predecessor, X, is sufficiently small, provided, in other words, that they are sufficiently close to one another in the space of all possible structures. If the answer to question 2 for any particular degree of difference is no, all we have to do is repeat the question for a smaller degree of difference. Carry on doing this until we find a degree of difference sufficiently small to give us a yes answer to question 2. X is defined as something very like a human eye, sufficiently similar that the human eye could plausibly have arisen by a single alteration in X. If you have a mental picture of X and you find it implausible that the human eye could have arisen directly from it, this simply means that you've chosen the wrong X. Make your mental picture of X progressively more like a human eye until you find an X that you do find plausible as an immediate predecessor to the human eye. There has to be one for you, even if your idea of what is plausible may be more or less cautious than mine. Now, having found an X such that the answer to question 2 is yes, we apply the same question to X itself. By the same reasoning, we must conclude that X could plausibly have arisen directly by a single change from something slightly different again, which we may call X prime. Obviously, we can then trace X prime back to something else, slightly different from it, X double prime, and so on. By interposing a large enough series of X's, we can derive the human eye from something not slightly different from itself, but very different from itself. We can walk a large distance across animal space, and our move will be plausible, provided we take small enough steps. We are now in a position to answer a third question.
3. Is there a continuous series of X's connecting the modern human eye to a state with no I at all?
It seems to me clear that the answer has to be yes, provided only that we allow ourselves a sufficiently large series of X's. You might feel that 1,000 X's is ample, but if you need more steps to make the total transition plausible in your mind, simply allow yourself to assume 10,000 X's. And if 10,000 is not enough for you, allow yourself 100,000, and so on. Obviously, the available time imposes an upper ceiling on this game, for there can be only one X per generation. In practice, the question therefore resolves itself into, has there been enough time for enough successive generations? We can't give a precise answer to the number of generations that would be necessary. What we do know is that geological time is awfully long. Just to give you an idea of the order of magnitude we are talking about, the number of generations that separate us from our earliest ancestors is certainly measured in the thousands of millions. Given, say, 100 million X's, we should be able to construct a plausible series of tiny gradations linking a human eye to just about anything. So far, by a process of more or less abstract reasoning, we have concluded that there is a series of imaginable X's, each sufficiently similar to its neighbours that it could plausibly turn into one of its neighbours, the whole series linking the human eye back to no eye at all. But we still haven't demonstrated that it is plausible that this series of X's actually existed. We have two more questions to answer.
4. Considering each member of the series of hypothetical X's connecting the human eye to no eye at all, is it plausible that every one of them was made available by random mutation of its predecessor?
This is really a question about embryology, not genetics, and it is an entirely separate question from the one that worried the Bishop of Birmingham and others. Mutation has to work by modifying the existing processes of embryonic development. It is arguable that certain kinds of embryonic process are highly amenable to variation in certain directions, recalcitrant to variation in others. I shall return to this matter in Chapter 11, so here I'll just stress again the difference between small change and large. The smaller the change you postulate, the smaller the difference between X double prime and X prime, the more embryologically plausible is the mutation concerned. In the previous chapter, we saw, on purely statistical grounds, that any particular large mutation is inherently less probable than any particular small mutation. Whatever problems may be raised by question 4, then, we can at least see that the smaller we make the difference between any given X prime and X double prime, the smaller will be the problems. My feeling is that, provided the difference between neighbouring intermediates in our series leading to the eye is sufficiently small, the necessary mutations are almost bound to be forthcoming. We are, after all, always talking about minor, quantitative changes in an existing embryonic process. Remember that, however complicated the embryological status quo may be in any given generation, each mutational change in the status quo can be very small and simple. We have one final question to answer.
5. Considering each member of the series of X's connecting the human eye to no eye at all, is it plausible that every one of them worked sufficiently well that it assisted the survival and reproduction of the animals concerned?
Rather oddly, some people have thought that the answer to this question is a self-evident no. For instance, I quote from Francis Hitching's book of 1982 called The Neck of the Giraffe, or Where Darwin Went Wrong. I could have quoted basically the same words from almost any Jehovah's Witness tract, but I chose this book because a reputable publisher, Pan Books, saw fit to publish it, despite a very large number of errors, which would quickly have been spotted if an unemployed biology graduate, or indeed undergraduate, had been asked to glance through the manuscript. My favourites, if you'll indulge me just two in-jokes, are the conferring of a knighthood on Professor John Maynard Smith, and the description of Professor Ernst Mayr, that eloquent and most unmathematical arch-critic of mathematical genetics, as the high priest of mathematical genetics.
For the eye to work, the following minimum perfectly coordinated steps have to take place. There are many others happening simultaneously, but even a grossly simplified description is enough to point up the problems for Darwinian theory. The eye must be clean and moist, maintained in this state by the interaction of the tear gland and movable eyelids, whose eyelashes also act as a crude filter against the sun. The light then passes through a small transparent section of the protective outer coating, the cornea, and continues via a lens which focuses it on the back of the retina. Here, 130 million light-sensitive rods and cones cause photochemical reactions which transform the light into electrical impulses. Some 1,000 million of these are transmitted every second by means that are not properly understood to a brain which then takes appropriate action. Now it is quite evident that if the slightest thing goes wrong en route, if the cornea is fuzzy or the pupil fails to dilate or the lens becomes opaque or the focusing goes wrong, then a recognizable image is not formed. The eye either functions as a whole or not at all. So how did it come to evolve by slow, steady, infinitesimally small Darwinian improvements? Is it really plausible that thousands upon thousands of lucky chance mutations happened coincidentally so that the lens and the retina, which cannot work without each other, evolved in synchrony? What survival value can there be in an eye that doesn't see?
This remarkable argument is very frequently made, presumably because people want to believe its conclusion. Consider the statement that if the slightest thing goes wrong, if the focusing goes wrong, a recognizable image is not formed. The odds cannot be far from 50-50 that you wear glasses. If you take them off and look around, would you agree that a recognizable image is not formed? If you are male, the odds are about 1 in 12 that you are colorblind. You may well be astigmatic. It is not unlikely that without glasses your vision is a misty blur. One of today's most distinguished, though not yet knighted, evolutionary theorists so seldom cleans his glasses that his vision is probably a misty blur anyway, but he seems to get along pretty well, and by his own account he used to play a mean game of monocular squash. If you've lost your glasses, it may be that you upset your friends by failing to recognize them in the street. But you yourself would be even more upset if somebody said to you, "Since your vision is now not absolutely perfect, you might as well go around with your eyes tight shut until you find your glasses again." Yet, that is essentially what the author of The Neck of the Giraffe is suggesting. He also states, as though it were obvious, that the lens and the retina cannot work without each other. On what authority? Someone close to me has had a cataract operation in both eyes. She has no lenses in her eyes at all. Without glasses, she couldn't even begin to play lawn tennis or aim a rifle. But she assures me that you are far better off with a lensless eye than with no eye at all. You can tell if you're about to walk into a wall or another person. If you were a wild creature, you could certainly use your lensless eye to detect the looming shape of a predator and the direction from which it was approaching. In a primitive world, where some creatures had no eyes at all and others had lensless eyes, the ones with lensless eyes would have all sorts of advantages. And there is a continuous series of X's such that each tiny improvement in sharpness of image, from swimming blur to perfect human vision, plausibly increases the organism's chances of surviving. The book goes on to quote Stephen Jay Gould, the noted Harvard paleontologist, as saying,
"We avoid the excellent question, what good is 5% of an eye, by arguing that the possessor of such an incipient structure did not use it for sight."
An ancient animal with 5% of an eye might indeed have used it for something other than sight, but it seems to me at least as likely that it used it for 5% vision. And actually, I don't think it is an excellent question. Vision that is 5% as good as yours or mine is very much worth having in comparison with no vision at all. So is 1% vision better than total blindness? And 6% is better than 5, 7% better than 6, and so on up the gradual, continuous series. This kind of problem has worried some people interested in animals that gain protection from predators by mimicry. Stick insects look like sticks, and so are saved from being eaten by birds. Leaf insects look like leaves. Many edible species of butterfly gain protection by resembling noxious or poisonous species. These resemblances are far more impressive than the resemblance of clouds to weasels. In many cases, they are more impressive than the resemblance of my insects to real insects. Real insects, after all, have 6 legs, not 8. Real natural selection has had at least 1 million times as many generations as I had in which to perfect the resemblance. We use the word mimicry for these cases not because we think that the animals consciously imitate other things, but because natural selection has favoured those individuals whose bodies were mistaken for those other things. To put it another way, ancestors of stick insects that did not resemble sticks did not leave descendants. The German-American geneticist Richard Goldschmidt is the most distinguished of those who have argued that the early evolution of such resemblances could not have been favoured by natural selection. As Gould, an admirer of Goldschmidt, said of dung-mimicking insects, "Can there be any edge in looking 5% like a turd?" Largely through Gould's influence, it has recently become fashionable to say that Goldschmidt was underrated in his own lifetime and that he really has much to teach us. Here is a sample of his reasoning.
Ford speaks of any mutation which chances to give a remote resemblance to a more protected species from which some advantage, however slight, might accrue. We must ask how remote the resemblance can be to have selective value. Can we really assume that the birds and monkeys, and also mantids, are such wonderful observers, or that some very clever ones among them are, to notice a remote resemblance and be repelled by it? I think that this is asking too much.
Such sarcasm ill becomes anybody on the shaky ground that Goldschmidt here treads. Wonderful observers, very clever ones among them. Anybody would think the birds and monkeys benefited from being fooled by the remote resemblance. Goldschmidt might rather have said, "Can we really assume that the birds, etc., are such poor observers, or that some very stupid ones among them are?" Nevertheless, there is a real dilemma here. The initial resemblance of the ancestral stick insect to a stick must have been very remote. A bird would need extremely poor vision to be fooled by it. Yet the resemblance of a modern stick insect to a stick is marvellously good, down to the last fine details of fake buds and leaf scars. The birds whose selective predation put the finishing touches to their evolution must, at least collectively, have had excellently good vision. They must have been extremely hard to fool, otherwise the insects would not have evolved to become as perfect mimics as they are. They would have remained relatively imperfect mimics. How can we resolve this apparent contradiction? One kind of answer suggests that bird vision has been improving over the same evolutionary time span as insect camouflage. Perhaps, to be a little facetious, an ancestral insect that looked only 5% like a turd would have fooled an ancestral bird with only 5% vision. But that is not the kind of answer I want to give. I suspect, indeed, that the whole process of evolution from remote resemblance to near-perfect mimicry has gone on rather rapidly many times over in different insect groups during the whole long period that bird vision has been just about as good as it is today. Another kind of answer that has been offered to the dilemma is the following. Perhaps each species of bird or monkey has poor vision and latches on to just one limited aspect of an insect. Maybe one predator species notices only the colour, another only the shape, another only the texture, and so on. Then an insect that resembles a stick in only one limited respect will fool one kind of predator, even though it is eaten by all other kinds of predators. As evolution progresses, more and more features of resemblance are added to the repertoire of the insects. The final, multifaceted perfection of mimicry has been put together by the summed natural selection provided by many different species of predators. No one predator sees the whole perfection of mimicry, only we do that. This seems to imply that only we are clever enough to see the mimicry in all its glory. Not only because of this human snobbishness, I prefer yet another explanation. This is that no matter how good any one predator's vision may be under some conditions, it can be exceedingly poor under other conditions. We can easily, in fact, appreciate from our own familiar experience the whole spectrum from exceedingly poor vision to excellent vision. If I am looking directly at a stick insect 8 inches in front of my nose and in strong daylight, I shall not be fooled by it. I shall notice the long legs hugging the line of the trunk. I may spot the unnatural symmetry which a real stick would not have. But if I, with the very same eyes and brain, am walking through a forest at dusk, I may well fail to distinguish almost any dull-coloured insect from the twigs that abound everywhere. The image of the insect may pass over the edge of my retina rather than the more acute central region. The insect may be 50 yards away, and so make only a tiny image on my retina. The light may be so poor that I can hardly see anything at all anyway.
In fact, it doesn't matter how remote, how poor is the resemblance of an insect to a stick. There must be some level of twilight or some degree of distance away from the eye or some degree of distraction of the predator's attention such that even a very good eye will be fooled by the remote resemblance. If you don't find that plausible for some particular example that you have imagined, just turn down the imaginary light a bit or move a bit further away from the imaginary object. The point is that many an insect was saved by an exceedingly slight resemblance to a twig or a leaf or a fall of dung on occasions when it was far away from a predator or on occasions when the predator was looking at it at dusk or looking at it through a fog or looking at it while distracted by a receptive female. And many an insect was saved, perhaps from the very same predator, by an uncannily close resemblance to a twig on occasions when the predator happened to be seeing it at relatively close range and in a good light. The important thing about light intensity, distance of insect from predator, distance of image from center of retina, and similar variables, is that they are all continuous variables. They vary by insensible degrees all the way from the extreme of invisibility to the extreme of visibility. Such continuous variables foster continuous and gradual evolution.
Richard Goldschmidt's problem, which was one of a set that made him resort for most of his professional life to the extreme belief that evolution takes great leaps rather than small steps, turns out to be no problem at all. And incidentally, we have also demonstrated to ourselves yet again that 5% vision is better than no vision at all. The quality of my vision right at the edge of my retina is probably even poorer than 5% of the quality at the center of my retina, however you care to measure quality. Yet I can still detect the presence of a large lorry or bus out of the extreme corner of my eye. Since I ride a bicycle to work every day, this fact has quite probably saved my life. I notice the difference on those occasions when it is raining and I wear a hat. The quality of our vision on a dark night must be far poorer than 5% of what it is at midday. Yet many an ancestor was probably saved through seeing something that really mattered, a saber-toothed tiger, perhaps, or a precipice in the middle of the night.
Every one of us knows from personal experience, for example on dark nights, that there is an insensibly graded continuous series running all the way from total blindness up to perfect vision, and that every step along this series confers significant benefits. By looking at the world through progressively defocused and focused binoculars, we can quickly convince ourselves that there is a graded series of focusing quality, each step in the series being an improvement over the previous one. By progressively turning the color balance knob of a color television set, we can convince ourselves that there is a graded series of progressive improvement from black and white to full color vision. The iris diaphragm that opens and shuts the pupil prevents us from being dazzled in bright light while allowing us to see in dim light. We all experience what it is like not to have an iris diaphragm when we are momentarily dazzled by oncoming car headlights. Unpleasant and even dangerous as this dazzling can be, it still doesn't mean that the whole eye ceases to work. The claim that the eye either functions as a whole or not at all turns out to be not merely false, but self-evidently false to anybody who thinks for 2 seconds about his own familiar experience.
Let us return to our question 5. Considering each member of the series of X's connecting the human eye to no eye at all, is it plausible that every one of them worked sufficiently well that it assisted the survival and reproduction of the animals concerned? We have now seen the silliness of the anti-evolutionist assumption that the answer is an obvious no, but is the answer yes? It is less obvious, but I think that it is. Not only is it clear that part of an eye is better than no eye at all, we also can find a plausible series of intermediates among modern animals. This doesn't mean, of course, that these modern intermediates really represent ancestral types, but it does show that intermediate designs are capable of working.
Some single-celled animals have a light-sensitive spot with a little pigment screen behind it. The screen shields it from light coming from one direction, which gives it some idea of where the light is coming from. Among many celled animals, various types of worm and some shellfish have a similar arrangement, but the pigment-backed light-sensitive cells are set in a little cup. This gives slightly better direction-finding capability, since each cell is selectively shielded from light rays coming into the cup from its own side. In a continuous series from flat sheet of light-sensitive cells through shallow cup to deep cup, each step in the series, however small or large the step, would be an optical improvement. Now, if you make a cup very deep and turn the sides over, you eventually make a lensless pinhole camera. There is a continuously graded series from shallow cup to pinhole camera. A pinhole camera forms a definite image. The smaller the pinhole, the sharper but dimmer the image. The larger the pinhole, the brighter but fuzzier the image. The swimming mollusk Nautilus, a rather strange squid-like creature that lives in a shell like the extinct ammonites, has a pair of pinhole cameras for eyes. The eye is basically the same shape as ours, but there's no lens, and the pupil is just a hole that lets the seawater into the hollow interior of the eye.
Actually, Nautilus is a bit of a puzzle in its own right. Why, in all the hundreds of millions of years since its ancestors first evolved a pinhole eye, did it never discover the principle of the lens? The advantage of a lens is that it allows the image to be both sharp and bright. What is worrying about Nautilus is that the quality of its retina suggests that it would really benefit greatly and immediately from a lens. It's like a hi-fi system with an excellent amplifier fed by a gramophone with a blunt needle. The system is crying out for a particular simple change. In genetic hyperspace, Nautilus appears to be sitting right next door to an obvious and immediate improvement, yet it doesn't take the small step necessary. Why not? Michael Land of Sussex University, our foremost authority on invertebrate eyes, is worried, and so am I. Is it that the necessary mutations cannot arise, given the way Nautilus embryos develop? I don't want to believe it, but I don't have a better explanation. At least Nautilus dramatizes the point that a lensless eye is better than no eye at all.
When you have a cup for an eye, almost any vaguely convex, vaguely transparent or even translucent material over its opening will constitute an improvement because of its slight lens-like properties. It collects light over its area and concentrates it on a smaller area of the retina. Once such a crude proto-lens is there, there is a continuously graded series of improvements, thickening it and making it more transparent and less distorting, the trend culminating in what we would all recognize as a true lens. Nautilus's relatives, the squids and octopuses, have a true lens very like ours, although their ancestors certainly evolved the whole camera-eye principle completely independently of ours. Incidentally, Michael Land reckons that there are 9 basic principles for image forming that eyes use, and that most of them have evolved many times independently. For instance, the curved dish reflector principle is radically different from our own camera eye. We use it in radio telescopes and also in our largest optical telescopes because it is easier to make a large mirror than a large lens. And it has been independently invented by various mollusks and crustaceans. Other crustaceans have a compound eye like insects, really a bank of lots of tiny eyes, while other mollusks, as we have seen, have a lensed camera eye like ours, or a pinhole camera eye. For each of these types of eye, stages corresponding to evolutionary intermediates exist as working eyes among modern animals.
Anti-evolution propaganda is full of alleged examples of complex systems that could not possibly have passed through a gradual series of intermediates. This is often just another case of the rather pathetic argument from personal incredulity that we met in Chapter 2. Immediately after the section on the eye, for example, the neck of the giraffe goes on to discuss the bombardier beetle, which...
squirts a lethal mixture of hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide into the face of its enemy. These two chemicals, when mixed together, literally explode. So in order to store them inside its body, the bombardier beetle has evolved a chemical inhibitor to make them harmless. At the moment the beetle squirts the liquid out of its tail, an anti-inhibitor is added to make the mixture explosive once again. The chain of events that could have led to the evolution of such a complex, coordinated and subtle process is beyond biological explanation on a simple step-by-step basis. The slightest alteration in the chemical balance would result immediately in a race of exploded beetles.
A biochemist colleague has kindly provided me with a bottle of hydrogen peroxide and enough hydroquinone for 50 bombardier beetles. I am now about to mix the two together. According to the above, they will explode in my face. Here goes. Well, I'm still here. I poured the hydrogen peroxide into the hydroquinone, and absolutely nothing happened. It didn't even get warm. Of course, I knew it wouldn't. I'm not that foolhardy. The statement that these two chemicals, when mixed together, literally explode, is quite simply false, although it is regularly repeated throughout creationist literature. If you're curious about the bombardier beetle, by the way, what actually happens is as follows. It is true that it squirts a scaldingly hot mixture of hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone at enemies. But hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone don't react violently together unless a catalyst is added. This is what the bombardier beetle does. As for the evolutionary precursors of the system, both hydrogen peroxide and various kinds of quinones are used for other purposes in body chemistry. The bombardier beetle's ancestors simply pressed into different service chemicals that already happened to be around. That's often how evolution works. On the same page of the book as the bombardier beetle passage is the question,
what use would be half a lung? Natural selection would surely eliminate creatures with such oddities, not preserve them.
In a healthy adult human, each of the two lungs is divided into about 300 million tiny chambers at the tips of a branching system of tubes. The architecture of these tubes resembles one of my biomorph trees. If, in that tree, the number of successive branchings determined by G9 is 8, the number of twig tips is 2 to the power 8, or 256. In each branching step, the number of twig tips successively doubles. In order to provide 300 million twig tips, only 29 successive doublings would be required. Note that there is a continuous gradation from a single chamber to 300 million tiny chambers, each step in the gradation being provided by another two-way branching. This transition can be accomplished in 29 branchings, which we may naively think of as a stately walk of 29 steps across genetic space.
In the lungs, the result of all this branching is that the surface area inside each lung is rather more than 70 square yards. Area is the important variable for a lung, for it is area that determines the rate at which oxygen can be taken in and waste carbon dioxide pushed out. Now, the thing about area is that it is a continuous variable. Area is not one of those things that you either have or you don't. It is a thing that you can have a little bit more of or a little bit less of. More than most things, lung area lends itself to gradual, step-by-step change all the way from 0 square yards up to 70 square yards. There are plenty of surgical patients walking around with only one lung, and some of them are down to a third of normal lung area. They may be walking, but they aren't walking very far nor very fast. That is the point. The effect of gradually reducing lung area is not an absolute all-or-none effect on survival. It is a gradual, continuously varying effect on how far you can walk and how fast. A gradual, continuously varying effect, indeed, on how long you can expect to live. Death doesn't suddenly arrive below a particular threshold lung area. It becomes gradually more probable as lung area decreases below an optimum, and as it increases above the same optimum, for different reasons connected with economic waste. The first of our ancestors to develop lungs almost certainly lived in water. We can get an idea of how they might have breathed by looking at modern fish. Most modern fish breathe in water with gills, But many species living in foul, swampy water supplement this by gulping air at the surface. They use the internal chamber of the mouth as a kind of crude proto-lung, and this cavity is sometimes enlarged into a breathing pocket rich in blood vessels. As we've seen, there's no problem in imagining a continuous series of X's connecting a single pocket to a branching set of 300 million pockets, as in a modern human lung. Interestingly, many modern fish have kept their pockets single and use it for a completely different purpose. Although it probably began as a lung, over the course of evolution it has become the swim bladder, an ingenious device with which the fish maintains itself as a hydrostat in permanent equilibrium. An animal without an air bladder inside it is normally slightly heavier than water, so sinks to the bottom. That is why sharks have to swim continuously to stop themselves sinking. An animal with large air pockets inside it, like us with our great lungs, tends to rise to the surface. Somewhere in the middle of this continuum, an animal with an air bladder of exactly the right size neither sinks nor rises, but floats steadily in effortless equilibrium. This is the trick that modern fish, other than sharks, have perfected. Unlike sharks, they don't waste energy preventing themselves from sinking. Their fins and tail are freed for guidance and rapid propulsion. They no longer rely on outside air to fill the bladder, but have special glands for manufacturing gas. Using these glands and other means, they accurately regulate the volume of gas in the bladder and hence keep themselves in precise hydrostatic equilibrium.
Several species of modern fish can leave the water. An extreme is the Indian climbing perch, which hardly ever goes into the water. It has independently evolved a quite different kind of lung from that of our ancestors, an air chamber surrounding the gills. Other fish live basically in water, but make brief forays out of it. This is probably what our ancestors did. The thing about forays is that their duration can vary continuously all the way down to zero. If you are a fish who basically lives and breathes in water, but who occasionally ventures on land, perhaps to cross from one mud puddle to another, thereby surviving a drought, you might benefit not just from half a lung, but from 1/100th of a lung. It doesn't matter how small your primordial lung is, there must be some time out of water that you can just endure with the lung, which is a little bit longer than you could have endured without the lung. Time is a continuous variable. There is no hard and fast divide between water-breathing and air-breathing animals. Different animals may spend 99% of their time in water, 98%, 97%, and so on, all the way to 0%. At every step of the way, some fractional increase in lung area will be an advantage. There is continuity, gradualism, all the way.
What use is half a wing? How did wings get their start? Many animals leap from bough to bough and sometimes fall to the ground. Especially in a small animal, the whole body surface catches the air and assists the leap, or breaks the fall, by acting as a crude aerofoil. Any tendency to increase the ratio of surface area to weight would help, for example, flaps of skin growing out in the angles of joints. From here, there is a continuous series of gradations to gliding wings and hence to flapping wings. Obviously, there are distances that could not have been jumped by the earliest animals with proto-wings. Equally obviously, for any degree of smallness or crudeness of ancestral air-catching surfaces, there must be some distance, however short, which can be jumped with the flap and which cannot be jumped without the flap. Or, if prototype wing flaps worked to break the animal's fall, you cannot say, below a certain size, the flaps would have been of no use at all. Once again, it doesn't matter how small and un-wing-like the first wing flaps were. There must be some height, call it H, such that an animal would just break its neck if it fell from that height, but would just survive if it fell from a slightly lower height. In this critical zone, any improvement in the body surface's ability to catch the air and break the fall, however slight that improvement, can make the difference between life and death. Natural selection will then favour slight prototype wing flaps. When these small wing flaps have become the norm, the critical height h will become slightly greater. Now a slight further increase in the wing flaps will make the difference between life and death, and so on until we have proper wings. There are animals alive today that beautifully illustrate every stage in the continuum. There are frogs that glide with big webs between their toes, tree snakes with flattened bodies that catch the air, lizards with flaps along their bodies, and several different kinds of mammals that glide with membranes stretched between their limbs, showing us the kind of way bats must have got their start. Contrary to the creationist literature, not only are animals with half a wing common, so are animals with a quarter of a wing, three quarters of a wing, and so on. The idea of a flying continuum becomes even more persuasive when we remember that very small animals tend to float gently in air, whatever their shape. The reason that this is persuasive is that there is an infinitesimally graded continuum from small to large.
The idea of tiny changes accumulated over many steps is an immensely powerful idea, capable of explaining an enormous range of things that would be otherwise inexplicable. How did snake venom get its start? Many animals bite, and any animal's spit contains proteins which, if they get into a wound, may cause an allergic reaction. Even so-called non-venomous snakes can give bites that cause a painful reaction in some people. And there is a continuous graded series from ordinary spit to deadly venom.
How did ears get their start? Any piece of skin can detect vibrations if they come in contact with vibrating objects. This is a natural outgrowth of the sense of touch. Natural selection could easily have enhanced this faculty by gradual degrees until it was sensitive enough to pick up very slight contact vibrations. At this point, it would automatically have been sensitive enough to pick up airborne vibrations of sufficient loudness and/or sufficient nearness of origin. Natural selection would then favour the evolution of special organs, ears, for picking up airborne vibrations originating from steadily increasing distances. It's easy to see that there would have been a continuous trajectory of step-by-step improvement all the way. How did echolocation get its start? Any animal that can hear at all may hear echoes. Blind humans frequently learn to make use of these echoes. A rudimentary version of such a skill in ancestral mammals would have provided ample raw material for natural selection to build upon, leading up by gradual degrees to the high perfection of bats.
5% vision is better than no vision at all. 5% hearing is better than no hearing at all. 5% flight efficiency is better than no flight at all. It is thoroughly believable that every organ or apparatus that we actually see is the product of a smooth trajectory through animal space, a trajectory in which every intermediate stage assisted survival and reproduction. Wherever we have an X in a real live animal, where X is some organ too complex to have arisen by chance in a single step, then according to the theory of evolution by natural selection, it must be the case that a fraction of an X is better than no X at all, and two fractions of an X must be better than one, and a whole X must be better than 9/10 of an X. I have no trouble at all in accepting that these statements are true of eyes, ears including bat ears, wings, camouflaged and mimicking insects, snake jaws, stings, cuckoo habits, and all the other examples trotted out in anti-evolution propaganda. No doubt there are plenty of conceivable X's for which these statements would not be true, plenty of conceivable evolutionary pathways for which the intermediates would not be improvements on their predecessors. But those X's are not found in the real world. Darwin wrote in The Origin of Species,
"If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous, successive, slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down."
1.5 centuries on, we know a lot more about animals and plants than Darwin did, and still not a single case is known to me of a complex organ that could not have been formed by numerous, successive, slight modifications. I do not believe that such a case will ever be found. If it is, I shall cease to believe in Darwinism. but it'll have to be a really complex organ, and as we'll see in later chapters, you have to be sophisticated about what you mean by slight. Sometimes the history of gradual intermediate stages is clearly written into the shape of modern animals, even taking the form of outright imperfections in the final design.